The Ominous Parallels, Part 6. On the whole, the Democrats do not feel the need to defend their politics by reference to any abstract theory, such as dialectical materialism or the dogmas of faith. If, as often been said, the essence of modern liberalism is social conscience unencumbered by ideology, then the Democratic Party was the purest representative of liberalism in Weimar Germany. Even this approach, however, rests on an implied philosophic base, which was voiced occasionally by certain party members. Thanks to these men, Germany's secular bourgeois liberals can be said to have stood for something intellectually distinctive. What they stood for was eloquently expressed the year before his death by the sociologist Max Weber, a major influence on the social sciences in Germany and one of the Democratic Party's most illustrious founders. In 1919, a group of students at the University of Munich, agitated by the Weimar Assembly debates and shaken by the violence in the country, invited Weber to address them. The students wanted guidance. They wanted this famous scholar-scientist to tell them what political system to endorse, how to judge values, what role science plays in the quest for truth. And this is a quote from Frederick Lilge. Weber knew what was on their minds. He also knew that a distrust of rational thought was already abroad, a feeling which at any time might assume alarming proportions. He therefore decided to impress upon his young audience from the outset the need for sanity and soberness of mind. They must not, Weber told the students, to be taken in by religious dogmatists, or by irrationalist charlatans, left or right, who pretend to offer solutions to the world's problems. The fact is, he explained, there are no solutions. Certainty is unattainable by man. Knowledge is provisional. Values are relative. Scholars are merely specialists doing technical jobs detached from life. Science has nothing to say about morality or politics. And this continues in Lilge's synopsis, it was therefore an error on the part of the students to demand from their academic teachers positive moral guidance and decisions, such as would be involved in answering the question as to what is the meaning of life. To attempt such an answer would transcend not only their work as scientists, it would also be a violation of the liberalism which Weber did his best to defend. Liberalism, according to Weber, means an end to illusions, including the illusion of human progress, along with an attitude of endurance. Endurance, in Lilge's words, to bear the instruction of all absolutes, the destruction of all absolutes, with no sentimental turning back or rash embrace of new faiths, only the strength to hold out in the radical, though bleak, veracity of a cleansed mind. As to selecting the proper course of action, Weber told the gathering, each individual has to decide the ideals that are right for him. Since only questions of means, not of ends, fall within the province of science, he said ends must be chosen subjectively by reference to feelings. The liberals of Weber's kind, equating absolutism with fanaticism, believe that the precondition of freedom is skepticism. To restrain mob violence and induce respect for reason, they believed, one should tell the mob that reason is helpless and that man must act on feeling. To slow the march of all of the all-powerful state, they believed, it was proper to endorse it in principle so long as one added that Germans should not act on principle, that is, go to extremes. To discredit the totalitarians, to silence the noisy cry that they had the answer to Germany's crisis, these men believed, one should tell a desperate country in weary, muted tones that sane men have no idea what to do and never will. This was the contest in the Weimar Assembly. The Romanticist nationalist groups, along with the Transitional Party of Independent Socialists, who sought a proletarian dictatorship, against the groups widely identified as the exponents of reason. These exponents were a coalition of half-hearted Marxists, dogmatic Catholics, and quaking skeptics. The debate on the Constitution began on February 24, 1919. The final draft was approved by a vote of 262 to 75 on July 31 and took effect as the country's fundamental law on August 14. The conservative parties and the independent socialists voted against the draft on the grounds that it offered the country too much freedom. The members of the Weimar Coalition voted yes unanimously. They recognized in the document not a partisan viewpoint, but the common base in which Germany's Republicans were prepared to stand in their battle to win the allegiance of the country. The Weimar Constitution is not a traditional Western Charter of Liberty. It is a distinctively 20th century document. Article 7 alone, for instance, confers on the federal government unlimited power to legislate on 20 subjects, including the press, public health, labor laws, expropriation, banking and exchanges, traffic in foodstuffs and articles of general consumption or satisfying daily wants, industry and mining, insurance, railways, theaters, and cinemas. In subsequent articles, the state is assigned further powers. Some of these are the power to lay down general principles concerning the rights and duties of religious bodies, public education, including the universities, housing and the distribution of the population, the power to preserve the purity and health and the social furtherance of the family, and the task of supervising the whole of the educational system. Having established its basic approach to government, the Constitution, striking a more traditional note, goes on to guarantee the protection of man's fundamental rights. It promises to protect the freedoms of expression, association, movement, emigration, the ownership of property, the inviolability of a man's home, and several other rights. The promise of freedom of movement, for instance, concludes with the words, "Restrictions can be imposed by federal law only." The promise of the secrecy of correspondence concludes, "Exceptions may be admitted by federal law only. There is to be no censorship, except in the case of movies or for the purpose of combating base and pornographic publications. The education of their children is the natural right of the parents, but the state has to watch over their activities in this direction. Personal freedom is inviolable," sums up Article 114, which continues directly. This is a quote, "No restraint or deprivation of personal liberty by the public power is admissible unless," guess what, "authorized by law." So you see, there's nothing then. Okay, no deprivation or restraint other than what the law might authorize. So you have nothing. Yeah, you got this, but unless the law decides you don't, you don't. So you don't have anything. And it's the same thing with the interpretation of the Constitution and everything else, or whatever laws that are being made in whatever sector. Because we live by U.S. codes more than we do by the Constitution. And you love the double talk. Well, that's government for you, no matter where you are. Sorry. The famous statement of this kind is Article 48, which was invoked by the German government in 1930 to justify the establishment of a presidential dictatorship. "If public order and security are seriously disturbed or endangered," the article says, "without further definition, the president," quote, "may take all steps necessary. He may suspend for the time being, either wholly or in part, the fundamental rights recognized elsewhere." The founding fathers of the United States accepted the concept of inalienable rights. "The public power," they said, "in essence, shall make no law abridging the freedom of the individual." The founding fathers of the Weimar Republic rejected this approach as rigid and antisocial. "The public power," their document says, "shall make no law abridging the freedom of the individual, except when it judges this to be in the public interest." But you see, as we found out, and as you know about the Constitution, where Peikoff's going with this, I'm sorry, but it's the same old vanilla sanitized fairy tale that we have gotten. Because in essence, what we have is exactly what Peikoff is explaining was in the Weimar Republic. It was the same thing. So, he's another guy that thinks that the founding fathers like got it together and all this other stuff, but it's the old story. If you have a president that can write executive orders, he's a dictator. He's a monarch. Well, we have this constitution, but it doesn't mean anything if the president wants to override it. You know what I mean? It's the same thing, and Peikoff can't figure it out, at least that element. That it's just the same thing in America. As a rule, the German moderates held political freedom works to benefit the public, and therefore it should not often be abridged. Besides, they felt such freedom pertains primarily to a man's inner life or spiritual concerns, which can safely be left to the decisions of the individual. Neither of these points they held applies in any comparable degree, to economic freedom. A businessman, they said, works for his own welfare, not the public's. Besides, he is up to his neck in materialistic concerns. This, the more religious Republicans felt, is a realm that invokes the lowest side of man, which must be firmly controlled by the authorities. This, the skeptics felt, is a realm vital to human survival, in which there can be no excuse, not even skepticism, for government inaction. This, the Marxists said, is the realm which counts in history, and therefore which belongs to the people. In the Weimar Assembly debates, the delegates never considered the possibility of extending freedom to the realm of production and trade. The moderates demanded that the government give up much of the Kaiser's control over the minds of the citizens, but they took it for granted that the government must never relinquish its grip over the citizens' productive actions. Imperial Germany had not been a purely statist economy, but a mixture of controls and an element of economic liberty, with the emphasis on controls. The Social Democrats in 1919 wanted just such a compromise as a transition measure. The liberals and the various groups wanted it as an end to itself. The conservatives wanted it in the name of tradition. Whatever their differences, the moderate consensus was, we do not want socialism, at least not now. We do not want capitalism, ever. We want a mixed economy. They got it, along with everything to which it leads. The essence of Weimar economics is stated in Article 151 of the Constitution. The organization of economic life, it says, and here we go with a quote, must accord with the principles of justice and aim at securing for all conditions of existence worthy of human beings. Within these limits, the individual is to be secured the enjoyment of economic freedom. Liberal legal compulsion is admissible only as far as necessary for the realization of threatened rights or to serve overriding claims of the common weal. Property is guaranteed, says Article 153, but property entails responsibilities. It should be put to such uses as to promote at any time the common good. Property, therefore, may be expropriated in the public interest. For the same reason, the distribution and the use of land are under state supervision. In addition, the government may, quote, convert into social property such private economic undertakings as are suitable for socialization, or it may demand the merger of such undertakings in the interests of collectivism. The Weimar Constitution concludes by mandating the programs of the welfare state and by promising the government will take special steps to protect the interests of the independent middle class and of the laboring classes everywhere. The German Republic has been called the freest republic in history. It is often described as an experiment in freedom which tragically failed. If so, it was a special kind of experiment, one that proved to be a pace setter for the rest of the world. The German Republic was an experiment in political freedom combined with the economic authoritarianism and defended by reference to the ethics of altruism. The country's Republicans did not wish to choose between freedom and altruism. They thought that they could have both. Every German, says Article 163, is under a moral obligation without prejudice to his personal liberty to exercise his mental and physical powers in such a way as the welfare of the community requires. In fact, however, it is either or, and the moderates did have to choose, and they wrote their priorities all over their founding document. The transition from document to reality did not take long. While the contest between socialists and nationalists was taking place in the form of solemn debates at Weimar, a different version of the same contest was taking place in the streets of Berlin, Munich, and other German cities. In this arena, the contending forces were the communists and the Free Corps. During the war, a faction of young Marxists had broken away from the Social Democrats, denouncing the party's pro-war policy as a betrayal of the class struggle. These youths soon formed themselves into the Spartacus League, named after the rebellious Roman slave. Then, after the war, reorganized the group as the Communist Party of Germany. The party support came from two sources, a militant minority of workers and an influential elite of middle-class intellectuals centered in Berlin. In contrast to the Social Democrats, who they despised as social fascists, the communists experienced no ideological conflicts. They were not tempted to dilute their fundamental approach by mixing into it remnants of an opposite viewpoint. They did not vacillate over the issue of individual rights. They dismissed the concept as a rationalization designed to justify bourgeois privilege. They did not try simultaneously to uphold liberty and economic equality. They rejected the idea of liberty. Until we reach the classless society, they held, there can be no such thing as a society without rulers. Until the state withers away, the absolute state is an absolute. And now it is the turn of the workers. The workers, they said, echoing the words of LaSalle, will offer the nation a social dictatorship, in contrast to the egotism of the bourgeois society. Unlike their former colleagues among the Social Democrats, the communists were not willing to postpone the social revolution. They were socialist revolution. They were impatient to have their ideal now. It is pointless, said party leaders, to spend time trying to persuade or educate the class enemy. Since men's thought is a mere byproduct of economic factors, they claimed, and since the proletarian logic is beyond the grasp of the bourgeoisie, enemy ideas cannot be dealt with by argument or discussion. They could be answered effectively only by the forcible overthrow of the existing social system. For the same reason, the leader said, the party refuses, even as a transition measure, to participate in any parliamentary form of government. The alleged political equality of men under such a government, declared Rosa Luxemburg, the top Spartacist theoretician, is nothing but lies and falsehood so long as the economic power of capital still exists. The idea that you can introduce socialism without class struggle and by parliamentary majority decisions is a ludicrous petty bourgeois illusion. Socialism, said Rosa Luxemburg, does not mean getting together in a parliament and deciding on laws. For us, socialism means the smashing of the ruling classes with all the brutality that the proletariat is able to develop in the struggle. The Russian Bolsheviks, who were turning Moscow at the time into a world center of Marxist ideology, were eager to support those who shared their viewpoint. They supplied their German counterparts unstintingly with every necessity, including trained organizers, strategic guidance, literature, funds, and weapons. The German communists' first demand after the war was all power to the Soviets, that is, not to a representative National Assembly, but to the unelected councils of workers and soldiers that had sprung up across Germany in the wake of the Kaiser's collapse. The radicals, and this is a quote, "Coming from the street," said one social democrat at the time, "and hold placards under our noses saying all power to the workers and soldiers' councils. At the same time, however, they let you understand, if you do not want what we want, we will kick you out. They can only represent a force as long as they are in possession of the majority of the machine guns." Good point. In December 1918, a general congress of such councils convened in Berlin. By a large majority, the delegates backed the movement for a parliamentary republic and rejected the idea of a workers' dictatorship. The will of the people, it seemed, was unmistakable. The Spartacists, however, had grasped the lesson of Hegel and were undeterred. They understood that the people does not know what it wills. For 6 months through the summer of 1919, the communists proceeded to act as the people's vanguard. The party staged a nationwide campaign of violence designed to precipitate a civil war and overthrow the republic. These months were filled with communist-instigated riots, insurrections, putsches, marches on Berlin, seizures of buildings, angry mass strikes, and bloody street fighting, all of it adding up to an orgy and of anarchy and murder. The chaos in the country may be glimpsed from the fact that Bavaria in April 1919 had three competing governments, an elected one, which was ousted by a Soviet republic, announced by a group of left-wing, but not communist, intellectuals, which was challenged by another Soviet republic, led by communists. The Social Democrats, leading the national government, abhorred the eruptions of violence. They did not cease to preach the revolutionary exhortations of Marxism, which were their stock in trade. But at the same time, they urged their followers, who numbered in the millions, to take up arms against the communists. "Do you want the German Socialist Republic? Then help us create a people's force for the government that will be able to protect its dignity, its freedom of decision, and its activity against assaults and pushes. A government that cannot assert itself has no right to exist." The government's plea evoked no response from the workers. The party faithful were not communists, but they took the slogans of the Social Democrats seriously. They did want socialism, and they heard the communists demanding it too. However much the workers may have disliked the radicals' violence, they could not bring themselves actively to resist it. They were reluctant to fight against men who were, according to all the speeches of their own leaders, fellow proletarians, fellow comrades, fellow idealists. The workers were capable of a decisive action against an enemy identified as rightist. A year later, a national putsch in Berlin was defeated by a massive general strike. The Social Democratic leadership itself showed signs of a similar ambivalence. The party that was working to put down the Spartacist rebels was even capable on occasion of cooperating with the rebels' disruptive tactics. In March 1919, for instance, the communists called for general strike in Berlin, flaunting such slogans as "Down with the National Assembly," and "The revolution can only advance over the graves of the majority Social Democrats." The Social Democrats in Berlin first opposed the strike call, then abruptly decided to join the strike committees themselves, and finally, alarmed by the threat to life, resigned from them. The moderates joined in, despite the Spartacists' call for their slaughter, largely because of what had been called the rivalry of radicalism. The other left-wing groups had tried to surpass the Spartacists in revolutionary zeal. Such groups had to justify their existence. They had to show their followers and themselves that they, too, could be counted on for moral fervor and political action, as defined by the basic philosophy which all these groups shared. Qua Republicans, the Social Democrats did not want the Communists to win. Qua Marxists, the Social Democrats did not want the Communists to lose. The result was a party that could do little during a momentous national crisis except appease, vacillate, temporize, and hope that someone also would act. Social Democrats found someone else. In a faithful step, the party leadership turned to the one German group able and eager to put down the communists, the remnants of the Kaiser's army and of the old officer corps, and asked them to save the country. These men were open enemies of the republic, but they preferred it to a communist state for tactical reasons, a republic they felt would buy them time until conditions favored the establishment of a truly German system of government. In this manner, by the defaulted decision of the moderate left, the initiative in Germany and the basic responsibility for its future passed to the country's nationalist forces, specifically to the troops known at the time as the Free Corps. The Free Corps were bands of armed adventurers, primarily bitter young soldiers returned from the front, who, unable or unwilling to find employment, roamed the country and acted according to their feelings. In many cases, they were led by former junior army officers. Although mostly of middle-class origins, these soldiers hated the same basic enemy as the communists, the bourgeois mentality and way of life. Some even called themselves Bolshevists of the right. In place of the money-grubbing bourgeois system, they said, Germany needs idealism, passion for the fatherland, a Führer, and most important of all, action. They were seldom more specific. We could not, one of them said, answer the question that so often echoed from the other side of the gorge, that is, the middle-class establishment. What do you really want? And here's a black quote. We could not answer because we did not understand the question, and they could never have understood the answer. Over on the other side, they wanted property and permanence, and we wanted no system, no order, no platitudes, and no programs. We acted according to no plan, toward no established goal. Indeed, we did not act at all. Something acted in us. What do you believe in, you ask? Nothing besides action. When asked by an old monarchist what was the sense of their actions, one of them answered, there is sense only in danger. Marching into uncertainty is sense enough for us, because it answers the demands of our blood. Their blood led these fighters, who defiantly call themselves freebooters, outlaws, nihilists, to loot and to smash. They found the red terror of the Spartacists by unleashing a white terror of their own. And that wasn't found, but they fought. They fought the Reich's attempt to disband their units in 1920 by marching on the capital in an abortive attempt to overthrow the government, the Kapuche. In the name of German honor, they pronounced secret death sentences in vigilante courts, then carried out the sentences in wave after wave of political assassinations. What the Free Corps stood for, summarized one enthusiastic member, was robbery and plundering, arson and murder, a mixture of every passion and demoniacal fury. Jeez. The Free Corps did not consist only of soldiers. Next to the war veterans, writes one scholar, students formed the largest group in the Free Corps. For the most part, they were young idealists who despised peace and money-grabbing. Next to the racist officers, said the leader of Hitler's stormtroopers, Ernest Röhm, recalling his Free Corps days, it was primarily the aggressiveness and loyalty of the students that strengthened us. Yeah, they don't think too much either. Such were the men who, in a series of brutal armed confrontations, brutal on both sides, decisively crushed the Spartacist threat, thereby gaining at the expense of the hang-wringing moderates the prestige of national heroes. From this time on, the communists were forced, despite the ideology, to try to gain power by electoral means. The German nation, observes Ludwig von Mises, obtained parliamentary government as a gift from the hands of deadly foes of freedom, who waited for an opportunity to take back their present. Ideologically, the clash between communists and Free Corps was a clash between champions of the all-powerful state and seekers after an all-powerful leader, between activists eager for an unselfish socialist Germany and activists eager for an idealistic, non-capitalist fatherland, between brute force justified by economic determinism or dialectic logic and brute force justified by the demands of the blood. The clash was only a variant of the basic alternative that was being offered to the nation in the meetings of the Weimar Assembly. Wherever the German turned, to the left, to the right, to the center, to the decorous voices in Parliament, or to the gutters running with blood, he heard the same fundamental ideas. They were the same in politics, the same in ethics, the same in epistemology. This is how philosophy shapes the destiny of nations. If there is no dissent in regard to basic principles among a country's leading philosophic minds, there are principles that come in time to govern every social and political group in the land. Owing to the other factors, the groups may proliferate and may contend fiercely over variants, application, strategy, but they do not contend over essentials. In such a case, the country is offered an abundance of choices, among equivalents competing to push it to the same final outcome. It is common for observers to criticize the disunity of Weimar Germany, which it said prevented the anti-Nazi groups from dealing effectively with the threat posed by Hitler. In fact, the Germans were united, and this precisely was their curse. Their kind of unity, their unity on all the things that count in history, that is, on all the ideas. The effect of this unity was a world convulsion. The cause, however, like a silent tremor, had been hard to notice. It was only some deadly marks on paper made 150 years earlier by a purposeful figure at a solitary desk in the peaceful little town of Königsberg.